Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Let's Weekend. This episode is for January 29th, 2016. I am your host with the most, Brandon Perkins, and joining me today is Filippo Dinolfo and Chris Sologi, and probably Dan Reb, our good buddy, will probably be joining us at some point later on.
Yeah, if not, well, it'll just be a cozy episode with three of us.
Yeah.
Yep.
So what have we been up to this week? Let's start with you, Phil.
Well, I'm still making my way through the Iron Druid Chronicles. I'm still really enjoying that, and it's kind of fun to see the weird historical things that he twists to his own designs. It's really humorous and enjoyable series. So if you haven't had a chance to read those, they're like candy. They're really worth picking up. So I've been going through those. I've also been playing Guitar Hero Live, still making my way through that. Yeah, getting a little bit better at that, going through the achievements now that I've got basically all the ones that take a lot of time to get to, but aren't particularly hard. So, yeah, play Guitar Hero TV for 24 hours, score 100 million points in Guitar Hero TV, that kind of thing. It's just, they're not hard. It's just going to take a while to do those. But, yeah, I intend to get as many of the gamer score out of that game as I can. And apart from that, let's see. Oh, yeah. There's the last Street Fighter V beta is going on right now, and I've been playing a bit of that. And wondering why they decided to default fight requests to on for the main menu. I don't understand that logic at all. It's like, oh, let me just go and change my options. A new challenger enters. God damn it. Stop it. Yeah. Thankfully, you can very easily switch that off. It's just one of those, what was the thinking behind that? You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's, pretty much been my week. And how about you guys?
All right, what about you, Chris?
So I watched Laser Team earlier this week, which is the first movie from the Rooster Teeth guys. They funded this on Indiegogo last year, and we're the biggest funded movie on that service. So I've been interested in seeing how this turns out, and finally got my Blu-ray from that. And it's pretty good. It's obviously sort of a small indie movie made on a few million dollar budget, and they do their best with that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so the CG kind of looks a little bit cheesy, but it's still pretty good. It's funny.
Well, it's Rooster Teeth, so you kind of hope there'd be some humor in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. They have, the Rage Quit guy from Achievement Hunter. Mm-hmm. He's kind of He's the main guy on this,
yeah.
Along with Bernie Burns and Gavin Free, sort of the three of the four main people that get this the suit that crashes to the Earth, and instead of this this champion guy that they bred to help defend the Earth from aliens, so it's like here are the biggest idiots now have to protect the Earth.
Hmm.
So it's sort of that whole kind of plot line, but it's pretty good.
Sounds fun.
Sounds like Pixels, only it doesn't suck.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry about that. But, well, then again, Pixels stars Adam Sandler, so kind of guaranteed that anything he's in will end up sucking.
Yeah, especially now. Totally.
Yeah,
well, now it's
days,
all
man.
About the money.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty well known that at this point he kind of uses movie production as a way to get his to go on vacation, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, with the
and
people
kinda,
he likes.
Yeah. It kind of sucks because, I mean, he has been in some pretty decent stuff in the past.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Happy Gilmore, Punch Drunk Love.
Yeah.
Rain on Me.
Yeah.
Yeah. He has done some good movies, but lately it's not so hot.
He doesn't really have to try that much now.
Yeah.
That movie where he was the sort of man child having to earn his inheritance by going through school again. Mm-hmm. Which was mostly stupid, but had that one really memorable quote, so everybody loves it.
Yeah, and that movie had a David Bowie thing in there.
Yeah.
God damn it, you got to keep reminding us that he's gone now.
Yeah.
Then you realize how much of a pop culture figure he was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Besides that, I started watching Detective Conan, which is on Netflix now.
Conan, also known as Case Closed.
Yeah. They label it as Case Closed on there, but it's not the original ones that Funimation localized and all that. It's the Japanese original. I think I looked it up. The episodes that they're airing are from 2014. Because their season one is technically like season 18. But the first episode has a PS4 in it. So that was interesting. I enjoyed that. So their intro music is like J-rock, which completely clashes with sort of the grisly murder mystery thing that they do in the show.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but that's Japan for you. I mean, they're not really afraid of dissonance.
If you ever get a chance, yeah, just read the first volume of the manga, and you think it's going to be this cutesy little kid, and then a dude gets decapitated on a roller coaster, and blood just fires out of his neck.
Yeah, I've watched a bunch of the actual first season at Funimation license, so I've seen all that stuff. And yeah, I really like the show. It's a really good sort of murder mystery of the week sort of thing. Sort of trying to figure out what happens, though, with these newer episodes. First off, it's weird seeing a much more modern art style than like this stuff from the 90s sort of thing. It's like, man, this is really clean than what I was used to watching. And also, Conan's like does not try to hide that he's a kid detective. Because the first episode that I watched, he's pretty much eyeing the guy that he knows killed him. And he's just trying to figure out, okay, how the hell did you do this? What's the trick? Like, he's staring him down all that entire time. It's like, man, you're not even hiding anything. Then I found out, sort of reading a little bit, one of the girls in his little kid troop was the person, the teenage girl that made the poison that transformed him into a kid in the very first episode.
Yep.
And she tries to take it thinking it's going to kill her before the people, the evil organization that produced all that stuff, ends up turning into a kid, and then they become friends and anime happens.
Yep.
There's a new saying, anime happens.
Yeah. And I found out that show is actually 20 years old. January 96.
Yeah, it is. The manga is like 88 volumes at this point. Yeah. It's still ongoing.
Yeah, about 807 episodes, I think they're at right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to give you perspective, I think Dragon Ball Z is about 270. That's about three Dragon Ball Z's worth of episodes. I also looked on Wikipedia, like their list of longest running anime. There's one that's been running since the 60s, 69, I think it was. 7,000 episodes. They're like 5-minute episodes, so
yeah, I think
a lot easier to produce. But
is that a Sazae-san?
I think so.
Yep.
And I was looking at the list trying to figure out, okay, which one of these do I know? It's like Case Closed is like the highest one I know of, Detective Conan. And the rest, like there's Naruto has almost twice as many episodes, like Shippuden, twice as many episodes than the original show did.
Yeah.
It's all the One Piece is like 700 something episodes.
Mm-hmm.
It's like these shows are so big, you could sit there and watch one episode a day, and it'd take you 2 or 3 years to get caught up.
Oh, yeah.
Just straight watching them all. It's like, man, that's. I tried to watch one up and One Piece and get caught up, and then like 200 episodes in, it's like, man, this keeps going. Let's see. I'm finishing up Crisis on Infinite Earth. I've got it right here on my phone, right in front of me. Sort of reading it when I get a little bit of downtime. pretty much at the end.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed it. I really like these sort of, let's get everybody into this whole thing, universe changing sort of little series. And it's really cool to see all this stuff from the 80s, especially. It's like, I know, you know, you kill off Supergirl, she's not going to be dead forever. You know, we know nobody dies forever. But it's pretty cool seeing, like, the whole anti-monitor thing. He just keeps coming back. It's like a huge trope of him just like, you think you've killed me, I'm not dying until you die. It's like, man, just fucking die and shut up, Ari. I know how this is going to end. Let's just get to the end, buddy.
Yeah.
I look forward to being done with Comixology, their app.
Yeah.
The good thing is now they're owned by Amazon. Pretty much Amazon has everything they have.
Yeah.
So I'll just stick to Amazon and enjoy the same selection, probably get more sales, and enjoy it on an app that I actually like to use. And I think my next comic thing I want to read is, I got the compendium for The Walking Dead, like the first 50 something.
That's going to be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. So I've read like the first issue a while ago. I already know that's where it's still pretty much the same as the show. Yeah. I know it's going to go splinter off pretty quickly. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that.
Just so you know, I live around that area. So if you're got any questions.
Yeah. Hmm. And yeah, so I started The Witness. I bought that on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a video about, I think about 30 minutes in, for about, essentially about 30 minutes, so about the first hour.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much since then, I'm about probably about 9-10 hours in now.
Mm-hmm.
I said a lot of stupid things in, no longer true, like, oh, these puzzles only take place on these little, like, touchscreen LED panels. No, they get away from that pretty quickly. And they go places all around this island.
Mm-hmm.
I've been exploring it. This is a perfect game to use on the PS4. Like, hook up your headset to the controller and just listen to the peacefulness of this island.
Mm-hmm.
Be able to pick up, like, okay, I'm near something because there's something humming. Sort of wandering around, being able to use all those sort of audio clues.
This sounds like a game that I actually would probably enjoy quite a bit because of that.
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you, I've been playing it too. The Witness is the most relaxing / infuriating game you will ever play.
Yeah.
Because
there's no life on this island, at least that I know of. That could change. But it's really peaceful because you're basically on an island, like a mist. And so you just hear the waves coming in, waterfalls, grass blowing in the wind, all that sort of stuff. Fake birds chirping. Once you find the speakers that are just playing bird sounds.
Okay.
Then you get to these puzzles and you're like, crap, what the hell is this all about? So there are, like, it's all grid-based puzzles for the most part, but they do a great job of introducing new mechanics and wrinkles and ideas to them in all throughout the island that you can't just say, okay, I know how to do this. I can finish everything else out. I constantly run into puzzles that I'm like, okay, I have no clue what to do with this one. I can't just brute force it. So I'm going to have to figure out, I'll keep an eye on this puzzle. And eventually you'll find areas that are technically the tutorial areas for these puzzles. And then they'll sort of run you through some of that stuff. And you're like, okay, now I got to go back, figure out where that puzzle was so I can get through this other area. So there's a little bit of a Metroid element to the puzzle stuff that I'm really liking. So now I don't know if you know of the, I guess it's kind of like a train yard a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Area right off of that big lake, I guess.
Yeah.
Those puzzles, I went through all the tutorials. I still have no idea what those puzzles. If you ask me to describe how that works, how that mechanic works in those puzzles to make these machines move, I still can't explain it. Mm. I barely understand it. It's really weird. Mm. But yeah, I am hopefully going to have a review at some point. Yeah. What I like is that there are a bunch of different areas, and I know from going up to where like the ending sequence will probably be taking off, that you don't have to go through every single puzzle or area. You just have to get through most of it. So I'm looking forward to finding sort of getting my bearings and sort of getting the rest of this stuff done. Yeah. What I really like is it's a great game for like the share button on the PS4. Because I take pictures constantly, especially of the puzzles. Because there are plenty of puzzles that are like, okay, I take a picture of this thing. It's like, now I got to recall it for this other puzzle. Or I end up using my Elgato, take pictures, take a screenshot, pull up Paint, and sort of diagram stuff out on it, sort of. And then I probably looked stupid earlier because I scooched up to the TV. It's like drawing out these like Tetris shapes on this puzzle. Like, okay, wait, I can do this. I think this is a solution. Let's try it. It's like all sorts of really cool stuff they got you doing. Just try to get these puzzles solved. So far, it's really good. I put it up with like Portal, the Swapper, Box Boy, those sorts of games. Sort of really great puzzle games.
Yeah. I'm going to have to play this one.
Yeah. If I'm on a Day Zero update, I'll definitely talk about it more.
Yeah.
After playing some more this weekend.
Cool.
And last thing, I started up Tiny Troopers. It's a PS4 game. I think it's also on PS3 and Vita as a port of a mobile game. It's a dual stick shooter. Sort of modern war base thing. It's bad. You think translating a dual stick shooter from a touch control style to physical buttons would make it control better, but it doesn't. And it's also because they have like that typical upgrade sort of thing. You earn cash playing the game to upgrade your abilities. They do that stupid thing where, okay, your control is going to be complete crap until you max out everything. It's like, that's a good way to make a bad game, is to start off with crap.
Yeah, it's a good way to sell microtransactions in a mobile game.
There's no microtransactions. It's just
crap.
You just got to grind. You just got to grind to get to the good controls.
Yeah, that's not good.
That's a good recipe for
badness.
Yeah, for me not recommending it to anybody ever.
Yeah, avoid.
Yeah, I'm trying to get through some of my backlog stuff, not necessarily just playing through these games, but just playing them, trying to see what's worth my time when I got some downtime.
Yeah.
And that game, I'm probably going to delete it at some point. Say, okay, I want the space back.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's it.
Cool. And you, Brennan?
Well, like Chris, I'm also enjoying The Witness. This is a game, even though it is completely different in almost every way, I still can't but help compare it to Braid, because it's much like Braid. It's filled with like all this symbolism, and on top of that, it's got what I like to call plotmosphere, where there's a lot of sort of things hinting at plot, but it's not quite there. You kind of have to look between the lines to find it.
Yeah.
And much like with Braid, you basically have to get all the things to get what's actually going on in the end.
Yeah.
And if you remember playing Braid, you remember that was a bitch to take care of.
Yeah. I never finished Braid. It was one of those games that didn't quite gel with me.
Yeah. Well, you'll definitely enjoy The Witness. For one thing, it's this, unlike Braid, you can really play this game at your own pace.
Yeah.
Well, it's
not a platformer for one. So.
No. And, you know, it's just the comparison to Myst is very apt, I think, because this is really what a current gen Myst would look like. It's very quiet. It's very peaceful. It's just you by yourself on an island with just the wind rustling through the trees and the water and the birds, or at least what you think are the birds.
Yeah.
And just all this stuff around here, you know, and although for the record, I did always wonder why in Myst, why did they have a spaceship on the middle of the, on the island for just no reason?
Because they could.
Because yeah, they could.
Just, yeah.
God, and Myst could get pretty dark too.
Yeah.
In certain places.
Yeah. Myst was also really obtuse as far as its puzzle logic went.
Oh, yeah.
So, and it's like, if The Witness does some of that, I probably wouldn't enjoy it. But if there's like actual logic behind the puzzles that they don't have to specifically, you know, call it out. But as long as it's there to figure out, then I'd probably be happy with that.
They do it in really subtle ways.
Yeah.
They don't just say, have like the pop up, like, this is how you do this. They just have some puzzles here, like five in a row usually. Hmm. It's like, okay, here's a very basic form of what this type of this mechanic is. Hmm. We're going to just add a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. Hmm. Then you get the idea of what you're doing.
Yeah, that's kind of the portal theory of the
design.
In fact, when you start the game, the first thing you do is you're basically walking through this corridor, and the first thing you see is a little computer, a little screen with a sort of really simple line puzzle where you just take one part and put it to the other end, and that basically just shows you how the whole game mechanic works.
Hmm.
And just very steadily, and it just sort of teaches you how the mechanics work. Like with the first one, okay, you take this and go here, boom. Okay, you take this and you go here, and you got it. You can't pass over the line. You can only go in one direction, boom, just like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they definitely, it's all like mazes at first. Hmm. Just like,
yeah,
figure out how to get from one end to the other.
Hmm.
And if you've played a bunch of the game, you could start a fresh game and just go through all this stuff you know, build up for right away.
Mm-hmm.
No real working for it. They don't limit you to anything. Just figuring out where it is, how to do it, and you're good to go.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of like this whole island is like a big escape room kind of game.
Mm.
Like it's somehow some rich, crazy person just bought this whole island, built a bunch of crazy puzzles all over it, and just drugged you and left you on this island. It's kind of like,
it's like, have fun.
Yeah, kind of like the island from Lost. Like, here, go figure out all the crazy secrets on this island.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, let's see. Enjoying The Witness. Of course, I am still playing, you know, Darkest Dungeon and Bloodborne and that other stuff, and I'll probably talk a bit more about Darkest Dungeon on the update, because I didn't get to talk about it much last time,
right?
Because we had that interview.
Yeah.
Let's see. Other than that, let's see. I've been reading, obviously, which is just more or less the one big thing I do.
Yeah.
More than anything else, I've been reading a lot more comics. I've been reading this really great series called The Veil, which is written by one of my favorite comic book writers, Greg Rucka. And it's basically about this woman who may or may not be a demon summoned from hell, who wakes up naked in the middle of this subway station, walks out, and then over the course of the issues, she's slowly trying to figure out who she is, what she is, why she is there, and what her purpose is.
Hmm.
Let's see. I'm sorry I'm yawning so much. It's
yeah, it's been a long day.
Yeah. Also been reading this really great science fiction novel called Starship and Haiku, which is written by Sumto Sucharitkul, a.k.a. S.P. Sumtow. Sumtow, for those who don't know, he is primarily known as a composer of contemporary classical and avant-garde music. He's originally from Thailand, and this was actually the first novel he published back in the 80s. And it's basically what, if Yukio Mishima decided to write a science fiction novel, this is basically what it would be like.
Okay.
It's basically about, it's like a millennia after this horrific war that basically destroyed much of Earth's civilization. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the whales, which people thought were extinct, suddenly start showing up again, and they can actually talk. And then they actually begin to sing, and it basically convinces all of the people in Japan that they need to go and basically, well, I'm not quite sure yet because I haven't gotten that far, but they have to go off and do something. But the thing is, one of the guys who's leading it is this guy called Takahashi, who is basically gone in completely insane and is convinced that he is supposed to be humanity's death lord. And so he sees himself as this artist who wants to create what he calls a living haiku and end it with the death of humanity.
Okay.
Yeah, like I said, this is really something like if Mishima wrote a science fiction novel. So if you've ever read Mishima before, you kind of have a general idea of what the sort of overall atmosphere is.
If you like stuff that gets pretty dark. Yeah.
Pretty dark. He is obsessed with the whole concept of, you know, ritual suicide and finding a place to die, that type of thing.
Lovely.
Funny thing, Yukio Mishima, he's actually one of my favorite writers of all time as far as, you know, quote-unquote mainstream literature is concerned, but the man was absolutely insane.
Insane, I mean, or brilliant, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference.
Well, have you ever heard of how he ended up dying?
No, I haven't.
You have no idea how Yukio Mishima died?
Nope.
Well, in the 70s, he founded this group called the Shield Society, which was basically a sort of old school militant ultra-nationalist political organization of people who were dedicated to the old ideals of Bushido and giving their lives to the emperor. And then in 1974, he and these guys sort of went in and hijacked a self-defense force station in, I can't remember if it was Hokkaido or Tokyo, but anyway, they had like a list of demands, and he went out on a balcony and gave a speech to all the police officers, to all the SDF people that were gathered down. He got booed, of course, because, well, and then he went back inside and committed seppuku.
Okay.
When I mean he committed seppuku, I mean he literally, like the ritualistic of, you know, wrapping the sword in white cloth and then, you know, slicing his stomach open.
Yeah.
And then he had a second behind him who, you know, decapitated him with a katana.
Hey, if you're going to do it.
Who was then in turn beheaded by another person.
I got to make sure they're not coming back as a zombie or anything like that.
Yeah. And the thing is, they both did it in like the classical way where they beheaded it, but they left just a tiny little sliver of skin at the nape of the neck so that it wouldn't roll on the ground. Because Japan.
Yeah. Thanks, Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, that Also, I went to Best Buy today and got a couple of things. First thing I got was a DVD slash Blu-ray of Ex Machina. Who here's seen that movie?
Haven't. Not wanted yet. To, but haven't gotten it yet.
Oh, it is freaking amazing. It is an amazing movie.
Yeah.
It's a very sort of high concept sci-fi movie that goes on things like on nature of things like artificial intelligence and androids and the nature of consciousness and all this stuff. And it was written and directed by Alex Garland, who's the guy who wrote the screenplays for stuff like The Beach and the Dread movie. Not the one with Sylvester Stallone, but the good one.
Okay.
Let's see what else he did. Sunshine, The Tesseract. Oh, he also did the screenplay for 28 Days Later.
Some film chops there.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, he's also one of the guys at Ninja Theory.
Huh.
So if you've played like Enslaved Odyssey to the West or DMC Devil May Cry, he worked on those too.
Okay.
He's also a novelist. He's written The Beach, The Tesseract, The Coma. He's a fairly well-rounded individual. But on top of that, I also went and picked up day one release, Dream Theater's The Astonishing.
Yeah, I'm waiting for my package for that, and it was supposed to arrive today, and it didn't.
Yeah, it's happy. An amazing goddamn album. It really is. They somehow managed to take one of the hokiest concepts in rock and roll concept albums and actually make it seem sincere and brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll probably have to describe that because I'm pretty sure a lot of people haven't heard of what it actually is.
Well, basically what it is it's a far-off future where this guy named Emperor Nefarious, basically he's a sort of autocrat who rules over this huge sort of feudal future society where, he sort of allocates all the wealth in such a way so that it creates economic dependency as well as extreme social stratification and general oppression. And one of the things that he uses is these machines called the Nomax, which are basically noise machines. And basically, music, as far as we know it in that society, doesn't exist anymore. All of the people, as far as music knows, is the stuff from the Nomax. It's just electronic noise. And then suddenly there's this guy named Gabriel who shows up, who's apparently a really talented guitar player because the whole thing was came up with by John Petrucci, who is the guitar player for Dream Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And he ends up joining up with this rebellion. And it sounds really hokey because it's been done like two or three times before by other bands, but they threw their hearts into it, and they added like a choir and an orchestra to it, and it's totally sincere. And it sounds great.
Yeah.
It really is.
2 hours and 10 minutes of prog metal amazingness.
Mm-hmm. And like that, Dream Theater, they have a website dedicated to this one album.
Yeah.
Where they show you the cast of characters and map of the universe, some images for like some of the locations. They give you a good 3D image of the Nomax. It's pretty amazing. They even have a thing where you can go and they'll sort of describe, they'll give you little snippets of some of the songs, and then they will, with the text, they'll describe, what's going on.
Yeah.
At this point in the story, it's just a freaking amazing album. It really is. Yeah. And I'm surprised I'm actually surprised of all the bands that Dream Theater hasn't done this before.
Yeah. And do you hear what they're doing as far as their touring with this album goes?
Far as I know, they're probably going to play a couple of shows where they play the whole thing in its entirety.
Yeah. The first couple of shows, I think the first show's in France. in February, and then they go out to, I think, London or Germany, and then, yeah, they're going to be playing the entire album, and they have a pretty elaborate audio-visual component of that as well.
Mm-hmm. So. It would not be unusual. They've played their entire albums of their stuff back-to-back at times.
Yeah.
And sometimes played other people's albums back-to-back at times.
Yeah, like Floyd and Metallica and
Iron Maiden. I think they did AC/DC at one point.
Yeah. Yeah, this album looks just amazing. I've heard one song off of it so far. They posted it on YouTube. It was a Moment of Betrayal.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, if you really, really want to, a bunch of people have already posted the whole album on YouTube. So,
yeah.
Wanna try before you buy, you got your chance.
Yeah, it's Dream Theater. I know I'm not going to be disappointed. Yeah. So,
I will admit, though, a lot of people, some people have problems with the last couple of their albums because Mike Portnoy isn't with them anymore. Mike Portnoy, for those who don't know, is the drummer.
Was
the drummer. But to be honest, though, although I love Dream Theater, I kind of got the sense that after a while he came to sort of just overall dominate the band. Like, it became less Dream Theater and more Mike Portnoy's Dream Theater. And
that was pretty clear now on Black Clouds and Silver Linings. That was like mostly his vision. There was like one song off of that. It was like a 16 or 17 minute song, basically dedicated to his father.
So, mm-hmm.
It was a great song, mind you.
Yeah, So now that he's not there, it kind of feels like the other members of the band have a chance to sort of breathe. And to be honest, I actually really like it. So
I liked the last couple of Dream Theater albums. I think, you know, they were. There was more variety to them, I found.
Yeah. You know, I loved, you know, the last album they did where they had, like, you know, they had the last album had a lot of sort of what made me love Dream Theater in the first place. It reminded me a lot of Images and Words and parts.
Yeah.
You know, they had the big power ballad and the, you know, the epic sort of rocker and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you tell we like Dream Theater?
Yeah, we really like Dream Theater.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm just waiting for my Amazon package to show up with that one.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because, you know, when I, you know, I started listening to Dream Theater when, you know, I was in middle school. And, you know, because I was, unlike all the other people, I was the guy who listened to the old classic rock station.
Yeah.
And, you know, classic rock station, you know, they would have, shows like The House of Hair, which was Dee Snider's thing, and he would occasionally play Dream Theater on there, and I remember hearing that, I'm like, damn, this is awesome.
Yeah.
You know, and so I got, you know, Images and Words and Metropolis Part 2, and, you know, just, it was awesome.
Yeah.
Great stuff. And it's so awesome now so that, you know, even though they aren't like a band who has a, you know, been on what we would consider the on the pop charts, except for that one time. They're still like really well known. They've really benefited from the internet.
Yeah.
So yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things. Now I realize that, you know, it's. Now that the internet is a thing, you know, it's become such a big part of what has made music now. You know, I look back at sort of those old days when I was in school and I just sort of – I just think, you know, man, how did we ever put up with all that crap?
Yeah, I mean, terrestrial radio, it used to be, it's like they'd play quote-unquote the hits and, you know, we didn't know any better.
Yeah, because I remember I was, you know, back when I was in, you know, eighth grade, early ninth grade, that was when the whole nu metal thing was the big thing in rock. and that's fine. You know, I was fine with it at first because I was like, well, at least something related to heavy metal is popular. Because, you know, up until then, it was mostly just hip hop, which is fine, but, you know.
Yeah. Can only take so much of
that kind of thing. I can only take so much of the thong song.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah. And that's about 30 seconds.
Yeah. But anyway, so. With that out of the way, let's go on to another installment of Brandon's Random Factoid. And this time I found us an individual who was just, frankly, she's my heroine, basically. My own personal little heroine. Mm-hmm. I want to tell you about a woman named Julie Diabony, who was better known as Mademoiselle Mapun. She was a 17th century swordswoman and opera singer.
That's a really interesting combination.
Okay, so she was born in 1673. Her father was a master of the horse for King Louis XIV. Now, the thing was, her father also trained the court pages, and so his daughter was there with him all the time, so she learned a lot of the stuff that the pages learned. So things like dancing, reading, drawing, and most importantly, fencing. She even started dressing as a boy from an early age. And then, by the age of 14, she was the mistress to the Count d'Armagnac, who had been married to Sire de Mapon of Saint-Germain-en-Laye. Soon after the wedding, her husband received an administrative position in the south of France, but she stayed behind in Paris. Then she started an affair, well, one of her many affairs with many different people, this one with a fencing master named Serenas. Then he was attempted to apprehend, the lieutenant general of police tried to apprehend him, and so they both fled to Marseille. Now, while they were on the run, they made their living by, first of all, giving fencing expeditions and also by singing. And like I said, Madame de Maupin was a very talented singer. But the thing is, she always dressed in male clothing. She didn't hide the fact that she was a woman, you know, like some of these old stories you hear. No, she didn't hide the fact that she was a woman. She just dressed in male clothing, probably because she just found it more comfortable.
Yeah.
And if you remember what it was that they dressed like back then,
yeah,
you can kind of understand why.
There's a lot of preparation went into women's clothing back then.
Yeah. So eventually when she was in Marseille, she joined up with an opera company singing under a maiden name. Eventually she grew bored of her affair with Serenas, so she then became involved with a young woman. But when this girl's parents found out, they tried to put her away in a convent in Avignon. But thing is, Mapin followed. And this is funny. She entered the convent as a postulant. And then so to run away with her new lover, she stole the body of a dead nun, placed it in the bed of her lover, and then set the room on fire to cover their escape.
That's hardcore.
Yeah. So they escaped, and the affair lasted for about 3 months before the lady finally returned to her family. And the thing was, Mapin was charged in absentia as a man, by the way, with kidnapping, body snatching, arson, and failing to appeal before the tribunal. So they sentenced her to death by fire. Keep in mind, she had fled the city, so she was in no danger at the moment. So she went off, earned her living by singing, started an affair with an old actor named Marechal. Then when she went to Villeperdue, she was insulted by a young nobleman while she was still wearing men's clothing. Fought a duel. She won. She drove her blade through his shoulder. She asked about his health and found out He was the son of the Duke of Lyon. One of his companions came to offer his apology. She went to his room, and as has become the culture with her, they started an affair.
Okay.
So let's see. Then she met a guy named Gabriel Devenue, who was another singer, and started an affair with him.
Damn, she gets around.
Oh, she did. And eventually she was able to contact the Count, her old lover, and was able to get her sentence taken care of. Then she signed on with the Paris Opera. She befriended an elderly singer named Bouvard, and then they convinced Jean-Nicolas de Francine, who was the master of the king's household, to accept her into the company. She performed pretty regularly for him. She was known as a very talented. People called her the most beautiful voice in the world. She was quite popular. She fell in love with yet again another female singer named Fanchot Moreau, but she didn't return her affections, and she sort of attempted to kill herself. It didn't work. Then while she was at a society ball, she made the mistake of kissing a young woman in front of everyone on the ballroom floor. She was challenged to a duel by three different noblemen, beat all three of them, ran afoul of the king's law because it forbade duels in Paris. Then she became the mistress of Maximilian Emmanuel, the Elector of Bavaria, returned to the opera, to the Paris opera later on. Then she sang in new opera companies, and eventually she died in 1707 at the age of 33.
She so packed a lot of living into that life, though.
Yeah. So let me tell you this. If you were to read like an adventure novel and have this woman as her main character, you would think somebody would have had to make her up, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Because it sounds completely just like a Mary Sue type of thing.
Yeah.
You know, not only is she beautiful, she's an amazing sword fighter, an amazing singer. She has these great affairs with both men and women all over Paris. But no, she was very much a real person. There are many, many evidence to her existence, including etchings and paintings of her. In fact, let me show you one. Let's see if I can find one. Okay. Let's see, like right here.
All right.
Like there's this one where she is posing with one of her dueling swords. Crap, hold on just a second. Damn it, Skype. There we go. All right.
God damn it, Skype. Why do you have to suck?
All right, there's one with her posing with her sword. Her rapier.
Yeah, it would be nice if...
Here's another one. Damn it.
Yeah, Skype's not having any of that, but anyway.
And then here's one with her wearing more feminine clothing, but once again with one of her dueling swords. So yeah, she was very much a real person, and yeah, she lived a lot of life in those 33 years, and kind of amazing she's not more well known, to be honest.
Are there any books and stuff about her? Because that's something I'd like to read.
There was this one author named Théophile Gautier, who was a Frenchman, who was asked to write a story about her, but he instead ended up writing a novel called Mademoiselle de Maupin, and he took aspects of her real life and then sort of went off and made an old fictional novel. Yeah. Again, his book was fiction, but Julie Diomini and her story is real.
Okay.
And, as far as I know, that's just about it.
Yeah.
She really deserves to be more well known, because there should be a movie made about her.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You know, keep in mind, she did all of this stuff in the 17th century.
Yeah.
In France.
Yeah. It's like
So, you know, I mean,
worst places to do that kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, HBO needs to get on this, is what I'm saying. They need to make a mini series about her.
Yeah. Yeah, forget
it's that. It's a good idea. It's a good idea for a new series of Dos Equis commercials.
Yeah. You can pack all the blood and tits you can possibly want and still be able to call it historically accurate. And that, my friends, has been yet another installment of Brandon's Random Factoid.
Yay.
This installment of Brandon's Random Factoid has been sponsored by Kentucky Fried Chicken. Kentucky Fried Chicken. We made this really shitty version of Nashville hot chicken, so you don't have to.
Yeah. Joy.
I'm serious, folks. Don't eat that stuff. If you want real Nashville hot chicken, just go to Nashville.
Yeah.
You'll thank me later.
Yep. And so will your stomach.
Yeah. Okay. So, with that out of the way, our first sort of big segment is, what are our top desert island albums? Basically, this is, you know, if you were stuck on a desert island, you could only have one album to listen to for your whole stay there, what would it be?
Yeah, well, I kind of didn't mean, like, just one album. I'm saying, like, I don't know, five or so, but
okay.
Either way, it's like, I kind of started by trying to narrow it down by decade because there's just too many really good albums.
And,
you know, CDs aren't really that big anyway. So for me, I started off with in 1969's In the Court of the Crimson King by King Crimson. Because, that album is just completely amazing. There's not a wasted minute in that album.
Only four songs on the whole album, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those, and it's four songs, but it's like all different styles. It's really amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's where I would start. And moving over to the 70s, well, it has to be Rush's 2112. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Yeah.
If I'm bringing an album from the 1970s, it is definitely that.
Yeah. So. Side note, when I said earlier about how the concept of The Astonishing had been done a couple times before, well,
yeah, that was
here's one of them.
Yep. Yep.
Okay, granted, that only lasted half of the album, but...
Yeah. Still, here's that one. Now, 1980s albums. There's a lot of really good music that came out in the 1980s. If I'm going to bring a 1980s album, though, it's got to be a Journey album. The question is, which one? And I thought about it, and it's going to have to be Frontiers. Yeah. You think the obvious choice would be Escape because of just all the how amazing that album is in general.
It's basically a greatest hits album on its own.
Yeah. But I think musically, Frontiers is stronger.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, you got Separate Ways, Worlds Apart, Chain Reaction, Only the Young, Rubicon, Edge of the Blade. The title track itself, Frontiers, was Troubled Child, Faithfully.
Wait, are you sure Only the Young was on there? Wasn't that the song that was on their greatest hits album?
No, that's Only the Young was on Frontiers.
Okay.
Yeah. What else was there? Of course, I mean, it's on the copy of Frontiers that I have. I don't know if it's maybe because of mine was a re-release still.
That's what I was thinking, because remember, they had the greatest hits album that came out in the late 80s. And I think that was where that song was originally put on.
Could be.
So
it ended up on a re-release of Frontiers, apparently.
Yeah.
So there's that. Now, 1990s is very difficult because there was all kinds of styles of music that were popular in the 90s. And if I'm going to have to pick one 1990s album that I'm going to be listening to the entire time, I think it's probably going to be Metallica's Black Album.
Yeah.
Again, there's no wasted motion in that album. It's just cover to cover, awesomeness. You got the really, really heavy stuff. You got some of the more melodic stuff. It's basically got everything you would possibly want in a Metallica album all in one package. Finally, like more modern stuff from today, I would probably end up picking Blackbird by Alter Bridge. Yeah, that's a bit of an interesting choice because, you know, Alter Bridge was Creed minus Scott Stapp. But let me tell you, it doesn't sound like Creed. Nope. In at all. And that title track, Blackbird, is just beautiful. Yeah. If you've never heard it, I highly recommend you check that one out. Because, right. It's pretty awesome. And, yeah, those are pretty much my five Desert Island albums.
So what about, like, the 2010s?
2010s is... I didn't actually go up that far. Yeah. Don't really know.
All right.
These what last, about you? Last few years of music, I'm not entirely sure there's really anything that sticks out for me. So.
All right. And well, what about you, Chris?
Oh, man. Let's see.
You don't have to be quite as extensive as was. Just.
Yeah, I'm just thinking because it's like if I was stuck on a desert island, I wouldn't necessarily try to pick like a certain type of music. I just pick music I like a lot.
You just make sure you had your iPhone with you.
Yeah, I just want good music. So it's like, I'd want like greatest hits of Queen.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
All great Queen songs, you know, have as long as you have, let's see, you know, Don't Stop Me Now or Under Pressure, just have some really good songs there. The Beatles, I'd probably do that. Like Here Comes the Sun's probably my favorite song of theirs. Just really nice, positive pickup music that you know want to listen to when you need to be happy. I'd probably throw some Guns N' Roses on there. You know, can always have what is it? Use Your Illusion.
Yeah, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2.
Yeah. Just have a bunch of great songs there. You know, just make sure you don't ever run out of awesome music.
Yeah.
You
know, for a band that's considered to be classic, you know, GNR has really only released 3 actual albums.
And like the first one they started was like, you know, here's pretty much it. You don't need everything else. Here's like some of their best stuff and it's really awesome. It still holds up really well.
Yeah.
I think I'd throw something like Stephen Lynch on there. He's a really good at making just funny music. And sort of having a little bit of comedy would be a good thing to have.
Yeah.
Especially somebody that can make music full of awful stuff. Music about like dating a neo-Nazi. And probably the Craig Machine would be the album I'd probably pick out of his stuff. Really good album.
Are you a Nazi, baby?
Yeah.
Are you a Nazi? A little Third Reich-y, baby.
Then he just yells at the audience, it's not me, it's the music. It's just what the songs say. Yeah, I'd probably throw Thriller on there. Great album to have.
Yeah, Thriller's a good album.
Maybe greatest hits of like Heart, some of these other good Pat Benatar.
Yeah.
Really good music to have. I'm trying to think of anything else. I don't know. Maybe throw the Life is Strange soundtrack on there.
Yeah.
Yeah, not bad.
There's all sorts of really good, just peaceful music there.
It's a hard question because there's just so much good music and it's like, what we just really want to have on
it's there. Like, screw you for putting this limit on here, 5 albums.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, screw you, Phil.
Hey. Yeah, I did that specifically, and I didn't include greatest hits just to make it harder.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, go ahead. So,
all right, so let me think. As far as the 60s are concerned, let's see, that would probably be MC5's first album, which was a live album that they did. If you ever want to know what the roots of punk music is, MC5's first album is pretty much ground zero.
Yeah.
Because those guys took the sort of political consciousness type of thing that was going on in music in the late 60s and Kick Out the Jams. That's what it was called. Hmm. It was recorded live at the Detroit's Grand Ballroom and during Devil's Night and Halloween 1968. You know, that album basically introduced the rest of American society to the term motherfucker.
Much to their chagrin.
Yeah. Because the most famous part is that song, Kick Out the Jams. And whenever the band MC5 gets back together and they do a reunion show, when he does that song, he has to go, now, because of this album, he has to go, all right, brothers and sisters, it's time to kick out the jams, motherfuckers.
Yeah.
So that's my 19. I'd probably also pair that up with the White Album.
Yeah, I can't really go wrong there.
Because it's the Beatles. As far as the 70s for me is really hard because that was the heyday of AOR.
Oh yeah.
You know, that was when as far as what do you think is the greatest decade for rock music? I would say it was the 70s.
Yeah.
Because you know, it's true that the 70s had disco and you know, in hindsight, we can look back and say, no, disco wasn't necessarily that bad. There was a lot of good disco, but it saturated the market so badly.
Yeah.
You know, and, but, you know, the 70s is when you had, like, the best of from bands like Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin. Mm. You know, Van Halen debuted during that decade.
Yep.
You know, Kiss was then it's a lot of those great sort of arena rock bands that were big, like Boston and you know, Kiss and you know, Alice Cooper was really huge.
Yep.
In the mid 70s.
Yeah. Early Aerosmith there as well.
Early Aerosmith. That was also when the punk scene started.
Yeah, I mean the Clash
as we know it. The Clash, the Sex Pistols, the Ramones, yeah. Velvet Underground.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's really difficult. But if I really had to do it, I would divide it to two albums. Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon and Yes's Fragile.
Mm. Very good albums.
Yeah. Pink Floyd, because it's Dark Side of the Moon. That is the pretty much pretty close to the perfect album.
Hmm.
It really is. And Fragile's Yes. Well, it's Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was basically the biggest bunch of egomaniacs to get together to record an album, but they were all amazingly talented.
Yeah.
So when they got together and cooperated, they produced stuff that was brilliant.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, 17-minute solos, no problem.
Yeah. Plus, they're both really great albums to get stoned to.
Yeah.
Because I'm assuming that this desert island is going to have a lot of, like, you know, just
interesting vegetation.
Yeah, just growing up out of the ground.
Yeah.
So, but let's see. And then we go into the 80s. And the thing with the 80s is there was some great albums that were in the mainstream. But the 80s is also really when sort of the underground music scene started to become a big deal.
Yeah.
So you've got like two fronts you have to choose from. So, God. And the thing is, you know, like you said, there's a bunch of amazing stuff that came out in the 80s, Journey included.
Hmm.
So as far as mainstream stuff, I would probably say Journey's Escape, but as far as like underground stuff is concerned, that's a little difficult because you had all the stuff coming out from not just the punk scene, but also the hip hop scene at the time.
Yeah.
You know, you had, Grandmaster Flash and, you know, Africa Bambaataa and NWA and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So if I really had to narrow it down, it would probably be, let's see. It would probably be the, let's see, where was it? Surfer Rosa, which is the first album by the Pixies.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting choice.
Yeah. Hmm. Because it's the Pixies, dude.
Yeah.
And that if you've ever heard that song, Where Is My Mind? That's where it comes from. Well,
yeah, that's,
that's where that song comes from.
Yeah.
Is from that album. Hmm. And if you ever feel like you're going crazy on a desert island, well, there's your perfect song for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I don't know if I want a song that would remind me of how crazy I'm going.
Yeah. I mean, a big part of that song is swimming in a cove with a bunch of fish avoiding you.
Mm.
It's, and except for this one koi who's trying to talk to you for some reason.
Yeah.
90s. The thing is, though, since I lived through the 90s, I'm not really sure, because the 90s had a lot of shit.
It did.
I mean, it had some great stuff, but it had a lot of shit, too.
Yeah.
I mean, the Spice Girls.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that was when the boy band thing was happening.
Yeah. So I'm guessing New Kids on the Block is not going to be on your...
New Kids on, no New Kids on the Block, no NSYNC, no Backstreet Boys, none of the more obscure ones like Incense or O-Town or BB Mac or any of that shit.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm close to 30 now, and I can look back and appreciate some of that stuff now, because, you know, ankle deep in teenage angst. But, yeah, at the time, it was just, it was insufferable.
Yeah.
It really was. So, for 90s, it would probably be, one, it would have to be Nirvana's Nevermind.
Yeah.
Because that was the defining album of the early 90s, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Surely an album that became number one solely due to the fact that everything that came out around that time was such shit.
Yeah.
Like, people honestly don't realize, how is it that an album like Nevermind could suddenly become the album of a generation? Well, the reason is because if you checked what was on the pop stations at the time, they didn't exactly have a whole lot of competition.
Well, I mean, this was the time when Vanilla Ice was popular.
Vanilla Ice, MC Hammer,
yeah,
freaking Michael Bolton and Celine Dion, and you know, and as far as the rock scene goes, you know, this was base hours of the hair metal thing.
Yeah.
But yeah,
the Simpsons had the 90s. Down pat in that Hullabalooza episode.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
I would probably pair that up with Evil Empire by Rage Against the Machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. Mm. That's when I really started to get my political consciousness stuff.
Yeah.
Plus, it's just a killer album.
Yeah, it is.
It really is. It's, you know, they gather around your face. It's full of shells.
Yeah.
Pearls, correct. Da 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 da.
Yeah, I was just playing that earlier today.
Yeah. Let's see. And obviously, since, you know, I went to high school during the 2000s, I kind of have to include them too.
Yeah.
I would probably put. Let me think. Probably Green Day's American Idiot in there. Because if you grew up in that era, like I did, You know, people make fun of Green Day now, and probably for really good reason. But if you grew up in that during from 2000 to 2008, that album just kind of defines how people really felt.
Yeah. Yeah. Plus, it's actually a really good album. It's a lot of really good songs on it.
Yeah.
And I'd probably also pair that up with Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge from My Chemical Romance. Well, no. Actually, I would pair not with Three Cheers for Sweet Revenge, but The Black Parade from My Chemical Romance, because I like My Chemical Romance.
That's okay.
You know, of all those bands that came out then, you know, they got sort of pigeonholed as sort of part of the emo scene, but they were much better than that. And probably pair that with This Is War from 30 Seconds to Mars.
Yeah, that was a good one, too.
Yeah, and that's mine, basically.
That's a very diverse set of musical selections.
Well, I had to, because there was just so much good stuff.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking in general, between the three of us, there's like, it basically runs the gamut of everything.
Well, it's pretty rock focused.
Yeah, mostly.
More or less.
Yeah.
But it's different generations of rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is one good thing you can say about the internet is it's sort of bridged the generation gap as far as a lot of this music is concerned.
Yeah.
You know,
I think a lot of the problem with music is high school, where you think, oh, I can't like this stuff because these are the type of people that like that stuff and I'm not like them.
Yeah.
You get out of high school and you're like, fuck everybody. I like what I like. Fuck you all.
Yeah.
I mean, I still freaking, you know, in 2000, what was it? 2004, I think it was. It was during my senior year and being out in the quad. Well, no, it wasn't 2004. It was actually early 2005. That was the year I graduated. And hearing people singing, you know, freaking Chris Brown, you know, that first song he became famous for, the one where he sounds really whiny.
Yeah.
The, you know, me, 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 me. I'm thinking, God, this is shit. Of course, 2005, as far as rock and concerned, was pretty shit anyway, because that was when, first of all, Simple Plans, How Could This Happen to Me? And I know you're going to hate me for this, but this is also the year that Nickelback produced Photograph.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a thing that happened in 2005. I do not confirm nor deny that I like Nickelback.
He likes Nickelback.
Yeah. Nickelback also produced Edge of a Revolution, so there's that.
Yeah, but they still produced Photograph.
Yeah.
I mean, them and Kid Rock are kind of the trains that keep on going.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kid Rock will, like, do collaborations with just about anybody at this point.
Yeah. Funny enough, I actually checked...
just do covers of your music.
Yeah. Funny enough, I checked the liner notes in one of his albums. I did not realize that Kid Rock basically plays most of the instruments on his albums.
Hmm.
He totally does.
Yeah. Yeah.
Granted, it's still shit, but...
Yeah. So, yeah.
And again, Photograph.
Yeah.
Look at this photograph!
I don't think they're ever going to be able to live that one down.
Every time I do, it makes me laugh. I don't know the lyrics of this shite. And I'm pretty sure the lead singer is the Antichrist!
Yeah.
Oh, you remember the Kid Rock thing from Rock Revolution?
Mm.
Where one of the producers on that game said, no one is more authentic than Kid Rock. Which says a lot about that game. I'm going to link to this, the Giant Bomb article, because they harped on this all the time around then.
Yeah.
I wanted to just make sure. Back when we were kids, Kid Rock was the guy who went from being a white rapper from Detroit to doing the rap rock thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now he does the Southern rock thing.
Yep.
/ country rock thing.
Yeah.
He's a suburban kid from Detroit.
Yeah.
Yeah, first he was like the Rock Eminem, and now he's I don't know, any number of things. Southern rock bands, just yeah. The modern version of that.
Yeah. Doing duets with Sheryl Crow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This was the guy who once, you know, in his entourage was just a little midget guy who was his hype man.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Just cause.
Now he's dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 3 foot, 2 foot tall with a 10 foot dick.
Might be why he died.
Because he released his own solo album at one point. Yeah. He actually released his solo album, and that was literally what one of the lyrics was.
Yep. Oh, dear.
I like the caption on this Giant Bomb article.
Mm.
Picture of him with the Coors Light can. It says 105% authentic under it. And it's another one under. Later on, it's him like singing. It's like, oh no, we have angered the beast. Run.
Yeah.
Those guys know how to do good subtitles for their pictures.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
There's another one. Him whipping his hair while wearing a cowboy hat. Air attack, 115% authenticity.
Yeah.
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 And you notice I didn't mention anything hip hop related. And the thing is, I do like hip hop, but you have to understand that back during the 90s when I was a kid, my parents wouldn't let me listen to it.
Yeah.
Because, well, have you looked at some of the lyrics lately?
Yeah. I think the lyrics to like hip hop songs have gotten more and more lewd and violent as time has gone on.
But the thing is, as far as hip hop is concerned, I mostly prefer either the alternative stuff like The Roots or The Coup, you know, or it's got to be like old school, like Grandmaster Flash or NWA, yeah. Or it's got to be like one of those horrorcore rappers like Low Key or MC Bush Pig or something like that.
Hmm.
Or MC Mangina.
Oh, okay. I never heard of him.
The most angry sounding Cockney woman you've ever heard.
Sure. Wow.
The internet is a really good influence on rap now.
Yeah.
Just do whatever the hell you want.
Yep.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really, I think the best example of the state of hip hop right now is, do you guys watch Key and Peele?
I do not.
Oh.
No.
Okay. So one of the sketches they had on Key and Peele was, they had this sort of thing where it was a music video, a collaboration between two guys. One of them was called The Struggle, and he was trying to be this sort of mature, socially conscious rapper. But then he had this Little John wannabe who would just go in going like, you know,
doing what Little John,
my ass is my church. My, you know, my ass is my church. My farts is my sermons. Your mouth is this, is the, is the Eucharist I shoot my holy sperm in. I got titties in my mouth. I got titties in my mouth. I got big tig old bitties in my mouth, mouth, mouth.
Yeah.
So on one side, you've got these really intelligent rappers trying to make a statement and, you know, like say Immortal Technique or someone like that. And then on the other side, you've got, you know, that idiot who made that song, I'm in Love with the Coco.
Hmm. Yeah.
I'm in love with the Coco. Baking soda. I have baking soda.
That doesn't really take much these days, does it?
No. And there's all like that stuff with the ICP a few years ago with the magnets.
Hmm.
Fucking magnets. How do they work?
Very well, thank you.
And, you know, I would like to blame Lil Jon for this, but let's be honest, the rap game was kind of degenerating before he came on the scene.
Yep.
And once they got rich and had no reason to really fight.
Yep.
Yeah.
They just did internet beef.
Yep.
I mean, guys like Biggie Smalls could pull it off, but yeah, it's just, you know, the thing you have to understand is really hip-hop came out of a place in the country that was going through some of the worst economic and racial injustice that was happening at the time.
Yeah.
You know, these were people who had, you know, like people like NWA people don't realize that if you re-look closely at NWA's music, this wasn't necessarily a glorification of everything. It was just a statement of what was really happening at the time, you know.
Yeah.
Eazy-E didn't want to be a drug dealer.
No.
He had to be a drug dealer because it was the only way he could make money at the time.
Yeah.
You know, and then all the other rappers came after him and just, yeah. But if you want, like, really good modern rap music, I would recommend The Coup. Immortal Technique. The Coup, they're a lead guy. Boots Riley. He did a really good, a really awesome collaboration with Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
Called The Sweet Sleeper, the Street Sweeper Social Club. That's actually really good.
Mm-hmm.
They got this really awesome song called The Guillotine that you need to listen to. It just it speaks to me.
Okay. Check that out.
Yeah. He's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But okay, so with that out of the way, let's move on to something a little bit closer to sort of our typical topics. Now, Chris, being the youngest among us, may not have quite experienced this stuff like we did, but back when we were kids, Nintendo sold out hard, and they basically hoarded themselves to whatever they could back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on top of that, they produced some really odd things, you know, peripherals and stuff that went with their systems. So, Phil, did you ever have anything like, you know, Rob or, you know?
Yeah, well, when I got my NES, I basically was able to get one without Rob because the first time I had played a NES was with Rob. It was at the rental store, and so it kind of came with it. So I rented it, and it was like, this is completely useless.
Yeah, and barely works.
And barely works, so... And it's like, yeah, why would I even want this? So when it came time for Christmas, when my parents got me an NES, the bundle with Out Rob was available, and that's the one I ended up getting.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Rob was not good. I don't even understand what the logic was in including that to begin with. Because it only worked with, like, two games.
And even then, it didn't work really well.
Yeah. And the games themselves weren't really great either. But, yeah. But that's the one that most people know about. It's like, do you guys remember the speed board?
I think I do. I think I do. Those of you who played Smash Brothers and, you know, saw Rob, who is actually a playable character. Well, now you know where he came from.
Yep.
Because for some reason, even though he completely sucked, he is still fondly remembered in the minds of Nintendo gamers.
Yeah.
Well, you can essentially give him credit for saving the industry as far as console games go around here.
Well, yeah.
Yes,
yeah. He did that. It's like he got the NES into toy stores again.
Well, this isn't a video game console. It's a toy.
Yeah.
See, entertainment system. See, no video games here.
Yeah.
So that was more or less they did it in spite of him.
Yeah, basically. It's just what they used to get him in the door. It really was just a gimmick that,
Work. But, you know, if you wanted a better gimmick, it was the Zapper.
Yeah.
And Duck Hunt.
Yeah. The Zapper, everybody remembers there, yeah.
Yeah,
the speedboard, as I alluded to earlier, was just stupid. This was a piece of plastic.
Yep.
You put on a table, and you clipped your controller into so that you wouldn't have to hold it so that you can push the buttons really, really fast.
Yep.
For games like Track and Field, they were thinking about this particular piece of crap.
Yeah. It was basically just a piece of plastic that you paid like $30 for.
Yeah, and I don't remember what the price was, but it was like, why?
Yeah, but there was other stuff like the you mentioned the track and field. There was the track and field mat.
Oh yeah, the power pad.
Yeah,
yeah, which basically ended up devolving into lying down on the ground and slapping it.
Because that's literally how people ended up playing that thing.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't do it properly. You'd break your ankles eventually.
Yeah. What Nintendo forgot to consider is that, running in place doesn't really work when your contact area is like 4 inches wide.
Right.
Just, yeah, they didn't really think that whole thing through.
I'm like, I know that the people in Japan tend to be smaller on average, but come on.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yep.
See, the bundle I ended up getting was the one with the Zapper and the Super Mario Duck Hunt.
Yeah, I think that was the one that cartridge. Was most common.
Yeah, and oh my God, did I play the crap out of that thing that Christmas?
Yeah, I think we all did. When we
but let's see, so there was that. There was also the they also put out one. What people don't realize is Nintendo also put out one of the first motion control peripherals long before the Wii.
Oh, dear.
Granted, yeah. It didn't work that well, but...
Yeah. The Power Glove. Oh, dear.
Yes, yes, the Power Glove. It's so bad.
Yes, it is.
And guess what? It did not in the way you think.
Yeah. Yeah, the Power Glove was, I think, the most diplomatic way I could say is... it was a valiant attempt, but yeah, like the one or two games that actually worked with it, like Super Glove Ball, you could kind of see where it might have gone, because, you know, it kind of tracks how your hand moves and you can go and catch the ball and throw it and do that, but it barely worked.
And then there was also that racing game that you could do with it.
Yeah, Rad Racer, which I think that was actually the only game that actually sort of kind of worked pretty well with it.
Huh.
Yeah, because there really wasn't much in the way of movement for that game. You just kind of tilted your wrist left and right.
And yeah, because, I mean, wasn't that the game they showed on the movie?
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah, because I was trying to remember what that was. So, yeah, there was that. I'm thinking of, actually, you brought up the Power Glove. There was another thing they had, too.
Yeah, that one wasn't actually made by Nintendo. It was, I think it was...
Rotorbund. U-Force?
Yeah, the U-Force, yeah.
Yeah. If you ever see this, just because Angry Video Game Nerd did a video on weird Nintendo peripherals, and he did one on this one.
Yeah, and the U-Force actually worked pretty well. I mean...
Yeah.
You know,
he still ended up losing to Glass Joe and Mike Tyson's Punch Out, but
yeah, but still.
And then there was the one where it was like a headset or something, and you could shout fire into it.
Yeah, that Konami laser scope.
Yeah,
it was basically a headset with a mic on it. And a zapper.
Yeah, except the thing was you could actually yell fuck into it, and it would have the same effect.
Yeah, it didn't actually care what you said, as long as it was just listening for a sound of a certain volume, and that's it. That's how it would trigger. Mm-hmm.
So on top of peripherals, there was also, you know, the merchandise, and oh my God, Nintendo had a ton of it back in the day.
Yeah, if you think amiibos are bad now, you ain't seen what they did back then. Oh my God.
They had breakfast cereal, for example.
Yeah, breakfast cereals, clothing. What else did they have?
They had the toys from McDonald's.
Yeah. Board games.
Board games, including both for Super Mario and Legend of Zelda.
Yeah. Which are very rare now. If you can actually find them, you're going to pay a pretty penny for.
Yeah. Actually, not bad, really, for kids' board games.
Yeah.
And of course they had the Super Mario Super Show.
Oh, yeah. Captain Lou Ferrigno.
Yes, Captain N.
Oh, yeah, and that too.
Yeah. Captain N is just the epitome of terrible tie-in cartoons.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
You've got first. What's weird is, for being a game related to Nintendo, it didn't have their most famous character in it.
No.
Mario was nowhere to be seen in that show.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing it's partly because it ran around the same time frame as the Super Mario Super Show did.
Yeah, probably.
So for whatever reason, I guess they didn't want to But that's weird because the Super Mario Super Show also had the Legend of Zelda bits, and they actually had a crossover with Captain N.
Yeah.
And in case you're wondering, this is the ones where you had Link going, "Excuse me, Princess."
Yep, I know. I have all of those episodes, all 13 of them. Taking up space on my hard drive.
You know, there's also the one where Mega Man was just this angry little green gnome.
Yeah, because clearly the people who had created that show had not actually played a Mega Man game.
No, they just looked at the cover art and then went from there.
Yeah. And that voice, that scruffy
smoker
voice.
It's not my birthday.
Yeah. And you had Simon Belmont, who didn't actually look like Simon Belmont.
And it was basically a preening pretty boy.
Yeah. It's
who basically fled at the first sight of danger.
Yeah.
Remember, this is the guy who takes on freaking Dracula.
Yeah.
And the main enemy was the Mother Brain from Metroid.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what it was supposed to be.
Yeah. And her henchman was like a King Hippo.
Yeah.
From
Eggplant Wizard from
Kid Icarus. Speaking of which,
yeah, Pit was
Kid
in
Icarus.
That.
Yeah, Pit was in it.
They call him Kid Icarus, but it was Pit.
And for whatever reason, he ended every sentence with Icarus.
Yeah, because of the 90s.
Yeah. No, it was, was it late? Was it 90s or late 80s? I can't remember.
Yeah, it's kind of boring.
Because a lot of this stuff came in around that time frame.
Yeah.
Now, granted, a lot of these, you know, they would eventually have a Super Mario 3 show, which was
marginally better.
Marginally better, because it had all the, you know, Mario 3 stuff added in.
Yeah.
But as there was that, and then, of course, there was the two most infamous tie-ins to Nintendo ever. The first, of course, being the Wizard.
Yeah, the Wizard.
The Wizard was literally a hour and a half commercial for Nintendo.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yep.
Anything relating to a story was incidental.
Yeah, there was kind of a story in there. It's it wasn't a very good one, but anyway, it was there.
The reason anybody watched that movie was for two reasons. One, they wanted to see what games the kids are going to be playing, including, you know, the NES version of Double Dragon on an arcade machine.
Yeah.
And somehow playing it during the opening sequence.
Yeah.
And then also to see the reveal for Super Mario Brothers 3.
Yeah. Which for me at the time wasn't a big reveal because I had the Famicom version.
Yeah.
Which most of us did at the time.
Well, yeah, you were Canadian.
Yeah, but, you know, it was still an imported game. It's like, as soon as we heard Super Mario 3 was coming out, we just went to the import shop and it's like, okay, get several copies of this and we will buy it.
And also that reference to, I love the glove. It's so bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, that comes from that movie, too.
Yeah.
And apparently he had, all 92,
Yeah, there were 92 games at the time.
Yeah. And he had it all, put up in that nice little vinyl case.
Yeah. Spoiled a little rich
zipper. I actually had one of those, too.
Yeah.
Because as you'd probably guess, I loved Nintendo back then, and obviously I still do, but I was a little kid, so I tried to pick up as many as I could.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this is combined with probably the most infamous and most terrible video game movie tie-in ever made.
Yeah. The Super Mario Brothers movie. Where do we even begin with that one?
You had one job. Now, I will openly admit that at the time, the Mario mythos did not have the level of depth that it has now.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, with the advent of, you know, Super Mario RPG and Paper Mario and all that, it sort of gave the Mario universe a little more depth of character. I will admit that they didn't necessarily have that much to work with. But how the hell did they come up with that?
Well, you know you're kind of in trouble when they're still working on the script while filming the movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there was a lot of issues in there, and it's like, I think the cast was mostly drunk while filming that movie.
Well, wouldn't you?
Yeah. So, yeah, that was not a good movie. Neither of the two characters were vaguely resembled the two characters from the games.
Well, maybe Bob Hoskins did somewhat.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Passing resemblance there. But Koopa was like, what? What the hell?
And the thing is, they even got the Mario things their ages backwards, because isn't Luigi supposed to be the older one?
No.
I can't remember.
No, actually, Mario's older.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Mario's older.
Yeah.
I don't think they had last names, though.
No, they didn't.
Not until that movie.
Yep.
Mario.
Yep.
Just and Mario. Luigi Mario. Yep. He's my brother, and he's also my dad. Somehow. And, yeah. You know, the princess was a wannabe, you know, Sarah Connor.
Yeah.
The whole movie was kind of like them trying to do the Terminator.
Yeah, and failing badly.
Yeah.
If you want a fun factoid, the woman that played the Princess Peach showed up in Under the Dome.
Wow.
She was a fairly important person early on, and then she dies.
Yeah. Joy.
I was watching that whole like first season trying to figure out, where the hell do I know her from? I looked it up. It's like, holy shit.
So, and the thing is, it's the weird way that they took bits and pieces of the Super Mario lore and inserted it in the movie in just the weirdest ways.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the primary way that, you know, Mario attacks in the games is to jump and stomp on characters. So they created an entire weapon based around it. The yeah. Stomper.
Yeah.
Which was loaded with bullet bills.
I don't think that's supposed to be how it works.
Yeah, and then the Goombas are basically Killer Croc ripoffs.
Yeah.
For some reason. And, you know, instead of having like fire flowers, they just have flamethrowers.
Yep. Oh, man.
They have those weird de-evolution guns, which I'm not sure what those are supposed to be. I guess they're a reference to how if Mario gets hit, he gets small again.
Yeah. Yeah.
They got the bullet bills right, at least.
Yeah.
I mean, not the bullet bills, the bomb bombs.
Yeah.
The bombs, yeah.
The bombs. The bomb.
Oh, no. It's a nuke. Nope. Treat it all like a nuke.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm surprised they actually didn't mass produce those for merchandise, because I would totally buy one of those.
Yeah.
Let's see, there was that. Yeah. There was, and of course, Bowser himself, which was Dennis Hopper.
Yeah.
Because basically chewing as much of the scenery as he possibly could. For some reason, there was this weird sort of running joke about his pizza. Oh, and did we mention that all this movie took place in an alternate universe where dinosaurs evolved into humans instead of apes evolving into humans?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's important.
For some reason.
Yeah. And they completely leave out the mushrooms, too.
Yeah.
Did they?
No, it was the whole king is turned into mushrooms.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
So he's all over the place. That's how you get Toadstool.
Hmm.
Obviously.
Oh, right. I forgot about that.
Hmm.
Crap.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've kind of tried to erase that movie from my memory.
Yeah.
You're making me want to watch it again, just for morbid
curiosity. Yeah, and there's Yoshi in there.
Yeah, Yoshi is a little
dinosaur
raptor thing.
That was pretty cool, because it's like Jurassic Park, dinosaurs, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's still, you know, the thing is, I really do think that you can make a good Mario movie.
Yeah, but at this point, I don't think it's ever going to happen. Yeah.
And I don't necessarily mean like a kiddie, like Pixar type movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still perfectly possible that you could make a sort of, because like, I've always had a thing for like those, what they call those alternate universe Mario art stuff.
Yeah.
Where they take sort of like, if you, because you look at the Mario universe and it's all cartoony and stuff, and it's like, oh, so cute. But if you made it into like realistic, you'd realize, holy shit, it's kind of nightmarish.
Yeah.
Because there's blocks floating everywhere. There's this giant mushroom people with faces. There's these huge plants trying to eat you.
Yeah.
There are these giant, like, turtles with wings.
Yeah. There's clouds with eyes floating around, filming you all the time.
Yeah. The bad guy has ships that he flies.
Yep, airships.
And tanks and jets and a fleet of battleships and...
Yeah, ships designed by M.C. Escher, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah! Yeah, that's what I'm saying, because those things make no freaking sense. I mean, they really don't.
Nope.
Explain that one, Miyamoto.
Yep.
It's like, I made a video game, shut up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's some good quotes on the wiki for their, like Bob Hoskins talking about this stuff. Says, in an interview with The Guardian, he asked, what is the worst job you've done? What has been your biggest disappointment? And if you could edit your past, what would you change? His answer to all three was Super Mario Brothers. He was also disparaging of the production. It was a nightmare, very honestly, that movie. It was a husband and wife directing team where both control freaks and wouldn't talk before they made decisions. Anyway, I was supposed to go down there for 5 weeks, and I was there for 17. It was so over budget.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, Bob Hoskins, he was playing Mario, but he was basically just replaying the character from Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Bob Hoskins, by the way, he's British. He was British. Very British, by the way.
Yep.
He was just such a good actor that...
Yeah, he could do whatever accent he needed to.
Yeah. But, yeah, so there was that. You have to understand. Yeah, we make fun of the amiibos and stuff, but Nintendo used to be way worse.
Yep.
I mean, way, way, way worse.
Yeah.
Well, that was just how things were back then when, you know, new movies came out, they would just produce all sorts of crap tied to it.
Yeah.
That's just kind of how people promoted stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the smarter companies know how to tone it down a little bit, though Disney, they'll just go, we're putting it on everything.
Yep.
Star Wars on oranges, all this stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. I remember back when the Street Fighter movie came out.
Oh my God.
And they did a tie-in with G.I. Joe.
For some reason.
Yeah. But the thing is, they didn't use the characters from the movie, they use the original characters from the game.
Yeah,
you have to look that up, because it's basically G.I. Joe with Street Fighter clothing.
Yeah.
It's weird. But, so there was that, and, you know, I'm pretty sure if we lived in Japan, there would be even more weird stuff we could talk about.
Oh yeah, probably.
They had internet stuff for the Famicom. You could do bank stuff with your NES or your Famicom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you also have to remember the original Famicom, it had the microphone and the second player controller.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like if you were playing Dragon Quest, you could actually, you know, shout the name of the spell into the microphone and it would do it.
At least in theory.
Yeah, the controllers were attached to the system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
the wire came out from the side.
Yeah.
Instead of
the cord length was like 3 feet long.
Yeah. And the not only were they attached to the system, but there was like these slots on the side of it where you put the controllers back in after you were done.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's actually
I will admit though, I actually it's kooky, but to be honest, I actually prefer the color scheme of the original Famicom to the NES we got over here.
Yeah. No, it was white and red. It was very colorful.
Yeah. Also, why was ours so much bigger than the Famicom was?
I think ours was supposed to look like a VCR, so yeah. It didn't look like a game console.
Yeah.
You know, and
that's why it has the front loader on it.
Yep.
Yeah. And then the thing is, they did the same shit for the Super Famicom, too.
Yeah.
You know, not only was it bigger.
No, the Super Famicom and the Super NES, they weren't that different in size. It was.
No, but the color scheme was off. I mean, yeah, it was still.
Yeah, color scheme changed, yeah.
Yeah. Like, the freaking buttons on the controller, the original Japanese one, you know, it was like a red, yellow, blue, green, you know, it was nice and pretty. And what did we get?
Gray
and sickly purple.
Yeah.
Lavender and purple.
Mm. Yeah, just lavender and, you know, boil on
Indigo.
Your ass purple.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, so if you haven't found out by now, number one, we're old, and number two, we basically grew up part of the Nintendo generation.
Yeah.
And so if you ever wondered why there's so much Super Mario stuff on the internet, well, it's because that's what we grew up with.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was video games for many years until Sega kind of came up with Sonic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, now Super Mario is literally a mainstream icon.
Yep.
He is he is as recognizable as Mickey Mouse or Bugs Bunny is.
Yeah. Mostly good times.
Yeah, mostly. we say mostly because, again, all the shit we just talked about.
Yep. Yeah, and I haven't even mentioned the Super Scope.
Yeah,
the Super
Scope.
Yeah, I had it too. And, you know, the thing was about the Super Scope, it had like maybe two or three good games and then a lot of shit.
Yeah, well, there was the Pac-Man game. There was Battle Clash. What was that other
There was
one?
The sequel.
Yeah.
Metal Warriors. Metal Combat.
Yeah.
And then there was Yoshi's Safari.
Yeah.
It was like a Tetris thing.
Yeah, that was part of Pac-Man.
Well, yeah. Yoshi's Safari was odd.
Yeah, I mostly ended up shooting Yoshi in the back of the head.
Yeah, because you could totally do that.
Yeah. It was just cool to have like a facsimile of a bazooka just to hang out in your room.
Yeah.
But I don't
understand.
A bit
of a design fault with that, though.
Yeah. Specifically?
The trigger.
Yeah.
It's in the wrong place.
Yes, the trigger is
on top.
On top. I'm pretty sure not even freaking rocket launchers are designed like that.
No. And it's like, it's made doubly worse by the fact that, yes, you have it on your, you have a shoulder mount, well, mount, shoulder thing. Then you,
shoulder rest.
Shoulder braced. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you also had a hand grip in the front, and that would have been a perfect place to put the trigger, but no.
No.
You had to basically contort yourself to be able to fire that goddamn thing.
Yeah. And if you were left-handed, you were fucked. But, yeah. shooting Yoshi in the back of the head, and he looks back at you, he's like,
"What the fuck,
how
dude?
Could you?" Turns out that Mario is an asshole. I did love the fact that you could sort of... That was sort of like the first time, though, that you could go through the Mario world sort of in the first person.
Yeah.
Because that was back before Mario 64 and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So it was... In that case, yeah, it was kind of neat.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was... The Super Scope was more of a failure than anything.
Yeah.
I did like Battle Clash, though. I just loved the concept of it. Because it was basically, you know, it was basically this sort of, like this sort of dystopian world where, you know, there were all these different nations had their, you know, their sort of representative athletes fighting in these battle mechs, basically.
Yeah. It was basically one-on-one flying mech combat. It's, you know, for concept, that's actually pretty darn cool.
Yeah. But,
yeah, execution left a little bit to be desired. And I think one of the problems with that game was just how damn long it took to finish a fight.
Yeah, because, see, here's the thing. You had your standard weapon was the machine gun, and it was shit.
Yeah.
Really, the only way you could do any damage was with a charge shot.
Yep.
But the thing was, is as you were doing a charge shot, you had to make do with, you know, your enemy fire.
Yep.
And, yeah, that could be difficult.
Yeah.
Because some of those later ones, they put out a lot of bullets.
Yep.
And that last boss is virtually impossible. But then, you know, and then there was that. But then, you know, you got Metal Combat, which I don't think a lot of people actually know exists.
Yeah. That was better.
But it's, yeah, it was better. Mm. It had kind of a downer ending, though. Because the guy dies.
Yeah. Yeah. No more Metal Combat games. Nope.
What a shame.
Yeah.
So terrible.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's... You know, I think, and except with the exception of the Amiibos, Nintendo kind of learned their lesson.
Yeah.
More or less.
Yeah. At least Amiibo is just one line.
Yeah. You could know. Be worse.
Yeah.
Could have fucking breakfast cereal.
Hmm.
And the breakfast cereal wasn't even that good either.
No. Pretty sure you could probably still get some on eBay. Not entirely sure you'd want to eat it at this point.
No. Not sure it's even solid at this point. It could have just melted, disintegrated.
Mm. Yeah.
And the weird thing was, it wasn't just that it was breakfast cereal. They had two types of breakfast cereal per box.
Yeah.
But the thing was, is that, you know, they didn't pack in any way so that you could block off one side. So nope. Just.
It was just all a mix of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think to finish it off, I thought we would do just a short little discussion of what our personal greatest moments in film are.
Hmm.
Like just like that, those moments from, you know, your favorite movies that you look back on and say, that is a classic moment in film. So like for Phil, what would be like your.
Hmm. Well, okay, let's see. Probably have to be part of, remember Spaceballs by Mel Brooks?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That scene where they go into ludicrous speed.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to stop.
Yeah.
And Dark Helmet is not tethered.
No.
Yeah. You just see him fly across the bridge and it's careening into a freaking console. It's like, oh my god. That was funny as
hell. Yeah.
Yeah. Or that one scene where they're watching the instant video cassette of Spaceballs, the movie that they're still actually making.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That whole movie was basically meant to be a sort of take you at Star Wars in every sense possible.
Yeah.
Like, not just the movie itself, but, like, the merchandising and...
Yeah. Spaceballs the flamethrower.
Spaceballs the breakfast cereal.
Yep.
Spaceballs the action figures.
Yep. You know, really need to do another Spaceballs. No, The Force Awakens is that.
They tried to do it with that cartoon show, and that didn't work out very well.
Yeah, but that didn't really count. They weren't really trying there. Mm-hmm. Besides, Star Wars was pretty old at that point, so.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, they had the, oh, right, we're trying not to talk about those.
Yeah. No Star Wars spoilers. Still, I mean, you can get, you know, Spaceballs The Schwartz Awakens.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. It's like, it writes itself.
Yeah.
There's somebody that does Spaceballs... theme poster is sort of like those Ollie Moss Force Awakens posters.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Sort of really good sort of stuff like with all the three main characters on there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Mel Brooks is still alive, isn't he?
Mel Brooks is, yeah.
He could totally make another one.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure, you know, if he could, if he played his cards right, Disney would probably even give him the funding to do it.
Probably. Fortunately, John Candy's not.
Yeah, unfortunately, John Candy isn't around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Damn.
So, wouldn't have anybody named Barf.
No.
Well, or they could probably find somebody to cast as him.
Yeah.
Seth Rogen.
Seth Rogen as Barf.
I'm pretty sure Rick Moranis isn't doing anything these days.
No, I don't think so. And, yeah, but that's mostly my stuff is basically from Spaceballs. It's the stuff that I remember most fondly, and that's where I go to. Keep firing, right, assholes.
Have you found anything? We ain't found shit.
You're combing the desert.
There's a point where they put in the movie version of themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just talking about that. Yeah. It's just, this is now. We're watching now. Well, then what happened to then? Then is then. Now is now.
Yep. When will then be now? Soon.
That movie could get really meta at times.
Yep.
So. You know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, Mel Brooks is one of my favorite filmmakers.
Yep.
So what about you, Chris?
Oh, man. I think that first scene of the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, it's great.
That one?
Yeah, that's when you got Spielberg at his best. Just,
yeah,
really inspiring.
That whole scene literally became an internet meme on its own.
Yep.
Especially on Vine. They got the one with the "what are those" guy. What are those? What are those? They got one with Donald Trump. Bing, 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 bong. Bing, 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 bong.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that CG still holds up compared to a lot of that stuff of that era.
Yeah.
Yeah, it totally does. Mm. I'm actually surprised. That movie came out in, what was it, 1996?
Almost like 92, 93.
Yeah. Mid-90s. And, yeah, that CG is amazingly still good.
Yeah.
Yeah, they mixed it with a lot of practical effects and all that.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I would say, to go with that, Hot Fuzz, the whole final scene. That movie is just some of the best written comedy ever.
Yeah.
That whole final scene is just where they just put everything they've set up right in there. Especially that fight with the priest. Shoots him in the foot and he goes, "Ah, Jesus Christ."
Oh, Jesus Christ.
She's like, "Man, you guys, I don't know why you guys can't just keep making movies.
Yeah.
You guys are fantastic at that stuff with Shaun of the Dead and all that."
Yeah.
Poor Roger Timothy Dalton getting his chin impaled on the...
Yeah, this incredibly funny movie and incredible gore.
Yeah.
Oh, God, that woolen hurts. I think I'm going to need some ice cream. Yeah.
The you killed a man good. Because of his typos.
Yeah.
The greater good.
For the greater good.
That movie's also really...
I love the living statue bit. Especially right at the end when they find him in the crypt underground.
Yeah.
He's still just sitting there like life.
Yarp.
Narp?
Yarp. That's also, on top of being really funny, that's one of those movies that's just really, really English, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Shaun of the Dead. Shaun of the Dead is just a very good cross section of what England was back then, in that.
Yeah.
You know, what it was like, it wasn't that long ago, but it's a really sort of good idea of what it was, of what it's like to be English.
Yeah.
Especially if you're like middle class, like Sean is.
Yep.
But so as for me, I'm actually going to go back because I actually love, I like movies in general, but I really also love old movies. Mm. I'll start first with my second favorite, which is, have any of y'all ever seen Cabaret? The original with, so Cabaret is basically about this guy, this writer, who is from the U.S., who goes to Berlin in the late 1930s to sort of help jumpstart writing his first novel. And while he's there, he finds himself in this cabaret at this, place that's a cabaret in Berlin, and if you ever do any research of what it was like to live in Germany, especially in Berlin in that era, basically people will tell you is that one half of Germany was basically drinking itself into a stupor and the other half was starving to death on the street corner. The country was experiencing extreme hyperinflation. The Weimar Republic was coming apart at the seams. There was open street fighting amongst political factions. And so in the middle of the movie, this main character, he's with a German friend of his, and they're drinking in the beer garden. And then suddenly the young man starts singing, "The sun in the meadow is summery warm." Granted, he's more on key than I am, but you turn around and it's this Hitler Youth, and he's singing this song called "Tomorrow Belongs to Me." It's what happens is it's actually this really beautiful song based around a traditional German folk song. But as the song goes on, you start to realize that he's talking about, like, the chorus is, Oh, fatherland, fatherland, show us the sign your children have waited to see. The morning will come when the world is mine. Tomorrow belongs to me. And then all the people in the beer hall start standing up and singing along. And then, the Hitler Youth puts on his hat and does the Nazi salute and everything. And it's a really good just sort of allegory for what was going on in Germany in the late 30s. Mm. Because you had all these people – on the one hand, you had all these people who were sort of going through this sort of almost suicidal hedonism, trying to forget the trauma of the Great War. But then you also had all these people who were caught in the middle, and then all of a sudden this really charismatic political group saying that they're going to make Germany great again shows up, and that, of course, was the National Socialist German Workers' Party, what we know as the Nazis. And it's just a really sort of eerie sort of allegory for what it was sort of like, just everybody, the Nazis were slowly rising and yet everybody was trying to ignore it.
Yeah.
So I pair that with what is, in my view, the greatest moment in film history. It's an old movie. It's Casablanca.
Hmm.
So Casablanca was this, it's considered to be like the classic American film. It was made back right during the middle in 1942 during World War II.
Yeah.
World War II was still a thing happening. People were still, Americans were still going over there with the Germans and the Soviets, and they were fighting the Italians and the Germans and the Japanese, and the war was there. So basically what this movie is it's about this guy named Rick Blaine, who's played by Humphrey Bogart, mm-hmm. who is He's the head of this sort of upscale nightclub and gambling den called the Rick's Cafe Americain. And it's in Casablanca, which is, if you don't know where that is actually in Morocco. And at the time, it was neutral ground. So what would happen is, because it was neutral ground, you would find people from every faction would show up in Morocco, and it wasn't unusual to see them all in one place. So like you would see German Nazis with their armbands, people from Vicky France, Italians, you'd see, you know, French refugees and, you know, all this stuff. And so the thing is, Rick Blaine is basically, he was a veteran of the Spanish Civil War. And he basically sort of got started this thing to sort of get away from all that. So what happens, though, is he ends up – well, basically he falls in love with this move – with this woman named Ilse Lund, who was played by Ingrid Bergman. But he's also being pursued by this – by this hold on. By this French woman named, hold on, named Yvonne, who he just kind of discards her. And this French woman, she was played by this woman named Madeleine LeBeau, and she was actually French, and that's going to be important in a second. So there's this point in the movie where Rick Blaine is talking with this guy named Laszlo. Laszlo is, first of all, he was played by this guy named Paul Hindred, who was an Austrian actor who had immigrated in 1935 to flee the Nazis. This character Laszlo, he basically works as a representative. He's a fugitive from the Czech resistance. He was part of the Czech resistance. He had to flee because of, you know, the Nazis. So in the middle of this movie, there's these letters that Rick Blaine has. They need these letters so that Laszlo can actually escape to the U.S. so he can continue his work with the Czech resistance, because he needs to go to an allied country. Remember, Morocco was neutral ground at the time. And the thing is, Rick Blaine actually is in possession of these letters. So Laszlo is trying to buy these letters from Rick, and Rick just refuses. He's made everything possible so that he doesn't have to have anything to do with this whole conflict. He just wants to get away with it. And so they're having this conversation, and then all of a sudden, there's these German Nazis who are over at a piano, and they are singing Die Wacht am Rhein, which is an old German folk drinking song. They originally were going to go, you know, with Deutschland über alles, but they did. The people who made the movie didn't want to do that, were afraid to do that because they could actually be sued by the Nazi government. So as they're playing this song, they're playing this song in the middle of a cafe filled with French refugees. And so Laszlo, he goes up to the house band and he says, "Play La Marseillaise, play it." And they look over to Rick, you know, Humphrey Bogart. Rick walks up. He just doesn't say a word, and he just nods his head. Do it. And so they all start singing La Marseillaise, you know. A la défense de la patria, de toute la gloire salive. You know, you're Canadian. You know this song.
I know the song, but that's not really the thing. Anyway.
Yeah. So, yeah, he's singing this, and then everybody else in the cafe jumps up and starts singing.
Yeah.
Like, they are singing their hearts out, you know. And then Yvonne, you know, who was played by Madeleine LeBou, an actual French actress, the camera cuts to her, and she's singing her heart out, and she's got tears pouring out of her eyes. And, you know, they're singing a song. They literally shame the Nazis into silence.
Yeah.
They just stop singing and sit back down. You know, and then the song gets bigger and bigger, and, you know, the orchestra comes in, and then it, you know, just crashes into its epic finish. And, you know, Yvonne shouts out, "Vive la France, vive la démocratie," you know, and it's just an awesome thing. Now, it's an awesome scene on itself, but here's what's going to make it even more awesome. All of those extras who played those French refugees were actual French refugees.
Mm-hmm.
Madeleine LeBou herself was a French refugee. Mm-hmm. She had actually fled Paris mere weeks before the Blitzkrieg started.
Mm-hmm.
And when they played that song, it was literally the first time she had heard her country's national anthem in almost a decade. So those tears you see in their eyes aren't called for in the script. They're real.
Yeah.
All that excitement you see, it's real.
Yeah.
That's the reason why it's my favorite scene in film, because not only is it a good scene, it's a representative of the zeitgeist that was happening in that time.
Yeah.
Just all of these events, from the fact that there's this huge destructive war happening on the other side of the Atlantic, that you've got all of these people in this movie, many of whom had actually experienced Nazi persecution firsthand. Because, by the way, I forgot to mention, the guys who played the Nazis, they were all German Jews.
Yeah.
Who had fled Germany.
Yeah.
So there's that. There's the fact that, you know, this movie was more or less made originally as a propaganda piece by the American government. It turned out to be an amazing movie, but that was kind of incidental. And the fact that, you know, it had two of the biggest stars of old Hollywood, you know, Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman. And you mix all of that together, and you've got a singularly unique moment in film that has never been repeated.
Yeah.
You know, it's very rare that you will have something that epic going on in the real world intersect in such a great movie.
Yeah.
So that's me. So I'm pretty sure I win.
Yep. You win the internet.
Nanny, nanny, boo, boo, stick your head in doo-doo.
Yeah, I wasn't aware this was a competition, but whatever, you win.
Well, I started the topic, so fuck you. Yeah. So, I think we got a show, folks.
Yeah, I think we can call it a week, night.
A night. Day, well, we're going to be back on Sunday.
Yep.
And, you know, and hopefully Patrick will be with us that day.
Yep.
With that, I am Brandon Perkins, and for Filippo D'Onofrio and Chris Sologi, get some sleep out there.
Bye.
Good night, folks.
Later.